You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it impacts you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible. We've got a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now, a shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and yes, the Kai PA glasses are back, but only while supplies last, and I'm taking some of them. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate. Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Epson, workforce all-in-one printers for business powered by Precision Core Technology, workforce printers for home offices, small offices, and network work groups. Epson.com.
Today's program is brought to you by three little letters, C, P, and I. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Robert W. Baird & Company, a financial partner keeping clients' best interests in mind since 1919. BairdWealth.com has more information. By Battelle, for 85 years, solving what matters most for consumers, businesses, and the government. Learn more at Battelle.org. And is supported by the University of Southern California.
In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, the 26th of February. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. We're going to begin today with something of a modest proposal by way of this morning's Consumer Price Index, CPI, as it's known. Inflation at the retail level fell 0.7% last month, the most in more than 5 years. That's not good, given where we are as an economy, but it's not as bad as you might think either, because once you take out the steep drop in oil and gas prices, what is called core inflation actually moved slightly upwards. So, back to the proposal. You know how every month, much ink and airtime is spilled on the unemployment report on jobs and labor ad infinitum. What if inflation were to become the key economic indicator? What then? Marketplace's Adam Allington reports.
Jobs in the labor market have held our national attention for so long, it almost seems kind of strange to now talk about inflation. University of Oregon economist Tim Dewey says the Federal Reserve has two main jobs. One is to maximize employment, which they seem to be making progress on.
The second condition is that they have to have sufficient confidence that inflation is going to trend back to target. So it doesn't have to be that inflation actually trends back to target. They have to have confidence that will trend back to target at some point in time.
And what is that target? It's 2% inflation. At that point, they've signaled they will raise interest rates, or in their own unique language, to tighten policy. And this is why people are so worried that prices are now headed in the wrong direction, which is to say downward. Milan Mulrain is an economist at TD Securities.
Essentially, it makes the inflation report or the next few inflation reports very important for the market in handicapping when the Fed actually starts and the pace at which they tighten policy.
Mulrain says were it not for the cheap price of oil, inflation would be a lot closer to 2%. He warns that if energy prices take another dive, it could push back the Fed's decision on raising interest rates.
I think another leg lower in global energy prices, then I think it's quite possible that the Fed will take a pass in September and could possibly push it all the way into 2016.
Mulrain says the biggest determinant of inflation is wages. He says they are trending positive and should ultimately push inflation back in the right direction, upward, despite the short-term drop caused by energy costs. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
All right, so about those energy costs. We have, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, more oil in our stockpiles right now than ever before. We have so much, we're basically running out of places to put the stuff. Ample supply, you might say. Why then, when the announcement came out yesterday, did oil prices fall? Think about that supply-demand thing. And then they fell again today. The truth is, a whole lot of things can move crude prices day to day, and those things may or may not have anything at all to do with where the market is headed long term. Marketplace's Dan Weissman zooms in on some of this week's fluctuations.
Traders were not surprised when U.S. crude inventories hit a new high yesterday. And that, says Walter Zimmerman, is why prices went up. He's chief technical analyst for United ICAP.
There's an old proverb. What everybody knows is already in the price.
In other words, yesterday's opening price of oil already included a discount for the oversupply that everybody expected to see. So when the news became official, prices didn't crash. And Zimmerman thinks that spooked some traders. Hey, wait, bad news came. Why aren't prices crashing? So they worried they'd bet too low, and they bid prices up a bit.
And this happens quite frequently. It's a feature of the landscape of oil trading.
Zimmerman thinks today's dip was a correction, but there's always another theory.
And it's also sometimes counterintuitive. I mean, today oil is down because the U.S. economy is good.
That's Phil Flynn. He's a senior market analyst with the Price Futures Group. And he means good news about the U.S. economy makes for a stronger U.S. dollar. So oil, priced in dollars, is more expensive for countries buying in, say, euros. Globally, that would mean weaker demand and lower prices. There are facts that shape oil markets over time, but trying to figure out which ones are the most important, that is really, really hard.
At the end of the day, it's supply and demand, but what goes into supply and demand just boggles the mind. You know, it's the story of the global economy. How's the global economy going to do?
As someone once said, it's hard to make predictions, especially about the future. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
In federal regulatory news this afternoon, a pair of llamas got loose in Sun City, Arizona today. The animals were eventually recaptured, but not before live video of the low-speed chase was streamed on bazillions of computers across the country. Oh, also, the Federal Communications Commission approved its new rules on net neutrality today. On Wall Street on this Thursday, come on, after the llamas, who really cares? We'll still have the details, though, when we do the numbers. The new record on Kickstarter, the most money raised in the shortest amount of time, is a cool $1 million in just 49 minutes. It happened Tuesday morning when Pebble, the smartwatch company, went back for a second round of crowdfunding. Pebble broke records during its first Kickstarter as well 3 years ago. Eric Mijakovsky is the founder and CEO of the company. Eric, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
As I sit here in the studio looking at the Kickstarter page for you guys, your second Kickstarter page, you have plus or minus $10.5 million for your latest venture, the Pebble Time. Once this is all said and done, what are you going to do with all that money?
It's going directly into the watches that our supporters have backed us for. We started on Kickstarter 3 years ago, and we brought out the first smartwatch to the world. We've come back with our next generation, and it's amazing to see the community rise up around us.
Well, that kind of goes to the real question that I have, which is, you know, you guys already have venture capital money, which you got after that very successful first Kickstarter campaign you did. Why'd you go back to Kickstarter instead of just getting more venture capital money? I mean,
so for us, it's actually not about the money. We're a profitable company. We've been profitable for the last 3 years. And we decided that the most efficient way to tell the story as well as get our watches out there was through Kickstarter.
Am I being too cynical if I encapsulate that as marketing via Kickstarter?
No, not at all. I mean, companies do marketing all the time. And in fact, it actually helps get the word out. It's helped incredibly. Like if you look at the last 3 days or two days.
Oh, yeah. No, totally. And this interview, right? And more to the point, this is marketing that actually pays you.
It is. But I'm a pretty blunt and pretty honest guy most of the time. It's a great source of marketing, but I think it's also a massive opportunity for us to engage with our customers and engage with the people who want to see us succeed.
All right, so let's get to the 800-pound gorilla then, the elephant in the room, if you will. Apple launches its smartwatch in a couple of months. They could buy and sell you guys with the change that they find in the couch cushions in the cafeteria. How are you going to compete?
Apple makes a ton of money off of a variety of their businesses. They're moving into the smartwatch space that we helped forge a couple years ago. But we're a company that doesn't have any distractions. We don't have an existing user base. We don't have any other sources of capital. This is what we do. And having another company like Apple come into the space is pretty good validation that what we're working on matters.
Tim Cook calls you up, the CEO of Apple, or Jeff Bezos at Amazon, or, you know, either of the guys at Google, and they say, we'll give you $1 billion for your company. What do you say?
That it's nice chatting with you. I like your phones, but I think we're in this for the long haul. We fundamentally believe that wearables will play a key role in how we interact with computers in the future, and Pebble's going to be a major part of that.
I want to scroll down on some of the items you have on your Kickstarter thing, and I want to go straight to the bottom. And this one caught my eye. It's called the distributor tier. If they give you $5,000 or more, and there's still some capacity left in this category, by the way, they get 30 watches, which I then gather you are okay with them reselling, since you call it the distributor tier.
Yeah, one of the things. So we did a Kickstarter 3 years ago, yeah. And we did the same thing there. One of the things that worked really well is it's difficult to get a retail presence worldwide. Creating a supply chain, creating a distribution system is difficult. So what we did is we figured out a way to get Pebble Time in the hands of small shops around the world at a competitive price, not below our MSRP. And it really helps users get the watch that they want without having to wait for us to kind of go through the motions of creating an entire supply chain around the world.
Eric Mijakovsky, he is the founder and CEO of Pebble, which, while we have been talking here, has gained another $100,000+ on Kickstarter. Eric, thanks very much.
Thanks very much, Kai.
Sears reported its 11th straight quarterly loss today, or measuring differently, it's been in the red for almost four solid years. The company's pinning its hope for a rebound on selling off some of its real estate, or selling off more of its real estate, to be accurate, because Sears has been selling its standalone stores for years now. But there is another category of Sears outlet out there, the ones that used to be those anchor tenants that brought shoppers into local malls. But since Sears and other big box retailers like them aren't doing as well as they used to, neither are the malls they inhabit. And so a lot of those mostly suburban malls are shutting down. Marketplace's Noel King went to the suburbs of Atlanta, Georgia, to find out what one does with all that now empty mall space.
When people talk about the death of the suburban shopping mall, this is kind of what they mean.
Are you guys shopping today?
No. We're walking. We're exercising to keep our heart and lungs going good.
Anne Rowe and her husband Bobby are walking laps around the Gwinnett Place Mall in Duluth. It's a middle-class mall, lots of shoe stores, a big JCPenney, a food court, Ace of Base on the overhead speakers. There's an entire wing of stores that have closed, and the mall is nearly empty. There are a handful of people in sweatsuits, striding with purpose, swinging their arms, more walkers. This mall was bought in 2013 by Moonbeam Capital Investments, a private equity fund. Moonbeam buys underperforming properties and redevelops them. It owns 11 malls. Shaul Pryor, the vice president of Moonbeam, says he sees potential here.
We're looking at making it more of an entertainment venue. We're looking at some office. We're looking at keeping a majority of the retail that we have here. We're looking at some restaurant concepts, real heavy restaurants, and we may even look at the residential side of it.
So a concrete plan for the 1.3 million square feet is still in the works. But Pryor insists the suburban mall is part of the fabric of American life.
I met my wife and we had our first date back in 1998 in the mall. Blind date, and we met in Ruby Tuesday.
What was the name?
Montgomery Mall.
Montgomery Mall in Montgomery, Alabama.
Montgomery, Alabama.
Is it still standing today?
It's not standing today.
What happened to Montgomery Mall?
Montgomery Mall's closed.
That space got a second life. It now houses a police precinct and a fire station. There are plans to put a magnet school there. This is happening all over the country, says Ellen Dunham Jones, a professor of architecture at Georgia Tech and co-author of Retrofitting Suburbia.
We've got about 215 malls in this country that are in various stages of being retrofitted and re-inhabited, redeveloped into all sorts of different things.
The reason? Malls are largely a suburban phenomenon, and a lot of retailers are leaving for better foot traffic. Cities are now a place to boost the bottom line.
Retailers, the Macy's, the Banana Republic, Pottery Barns, are recognizing that, in fact, their sales per square foot are higher if they're in a standalone store on a busy urban street than if they're in a mall.
Bad news for malls, but retail, like nature, abhors a vacuum.
Siempre la
Here is one of the malls in suburban Atlanta that has been successfully retrofitted and re-inhabited. Franco Vera is the GM of La Que Buena Radio, which 2 years ago started broadcasting from the Santa Fe Mall.
It's just a dream to be inside of a mall. Just being inside a mall is like a little CNN, kind of.
This was the Venture Mall. 12 years ago, a new owner turned it into a mall that specifically targets Hispanic shoppers. It's one of two Latin malls in suburban Atlanta. Stores sell massive cooking pots, ornate quinceañera dresses, and silver belt buckles. The food court is famous locally. Santa Fe Mall has a health clinic, offers seminars on immigration, weekend concerts, and Mexican wrestling. 19-year-old Lisbeth Reynoso, who's manning the counter at El Cerrito Western Wear, says ethnic malls work because they're comfortable.
People feel like it's like they're in Mexico because there's a lot of Hispanic people here. Like, you go to a store and people talk Spanish. You don't have to be like, oh my God, I don't know English, and how am I going to ask things?
So maybe this is the mall of the future, one that targets specific populations. But maybe not. Reynosa doesn't actually shop here. She says she prefers the Gwinnett Place Mall, the one with all of the walkers, because it has a Forever 21. In Atlanta, I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
Coming up,
water is oftentimes a zero-sum game. Somebody might end up with water, but somebody else can be cut off and lose completely.
Winners, losers, and water. But first, let's do the numbers. Kind of a ho-hum day, to be honest about it. The Dow Industrials dropped about 10 points, less than a 10%, closed at 18,214. The NASDAQ gained 20 points, 0.4%, finished at 49.87. The S&P 500 off 3 points, a 10%, ended things at 21.10. So where to start on a quiet day? Well, how about gold? Everybody likes gold, or at least traders did today. Gold prices were up, and so too were shares of Harmony Gold Mining, up 2%, as well as Goldcorp Inc., up 0.2%. Isn't that redundant, by the way? Silver as well. First Majestic Silver Corp., ticker symbol AG, for those who know the periodic table, was up 1.3%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.03%. And you? You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Fox Searchlight Pictures, the second best exotic Marigold Hotel, the new comedy starring Maggie Smith and Judi Dench, in theaters everywhere March 6th. By Farmers Insurance, out to educate everybody about common insurance gaps so that no one falls victim to them again. Learn more at farmers.com/innercircle. Farmers Insurance, know the gaps. And by Epson, with workforce all-in-one printers for business powered by Precision Core Technology, providing a full line of workforce printers designed for home offices, small offices, and networked work groups. Learn more at Epson.com. When you're not near a radio, listen to Marketplace on your cell phone or tablet. You can hear us on Slacker, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Flipboard, and more, or download our iPhone app. Find the option that's best for you at marketplace.org.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The Labor Department issues its second estimate for fourth quarter gross domestic product. The National Association of Realtors releases its pending home sales index for January. And class, which constitutional amendment says a U.S. president can only be elected to the office twice? If you said the 22nd Amendment, you get a gold star. It was ratified on February 27, 1951. Oh, heck, gold stars for everyone. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Facebook is going to be expanding its suicide prevention efforts. Users can already report potentially suicidal content posted by their friends when they see it. Now, both the person who posts and the friend who reports it will get a message directing them to mental health resources. The announcement came out of Facebook's fifth annual Compassion Research Day. Marketplace's Amy Scott has more now on compassion as business model.
About 5 years ago, Stephen Miller saw some posts that concerned him from a friend on Facebook.
I remember thinking, it's late at night, I don't really want to call him, I'm not quite sure what to do, I'll call him in the morning. And my friend died by suicide that night.
Miller is now operations manager at Forefront, a nonprofit suicide prevention group in Seattle. Forefront worked with Facebook to develop the new tools. If you see a troubling post and click to report it, Facebook will soon give you several options. You can message the friend directly, bring in other friends to help, or have Facebook look at the post. Choose that route and Facebook will contact the poster directly with information on getting help. Miller says one risk factor in suicide is not having access to resources.
What this does is it allows people to connect in a large way and provide support through a free platform.
But all of this makes some people nervous. Jamie Court with Consumer Watchdog says allowing people to flag their friends could lead to bullying and abuse. Then there are potential privacy concerns.
What happens to that record of that tag of someone who's suicidal? Can they ever erase it from their Facebook history, which is the property of Facebook?
Facebook says the reporting process is entirely confidential. The friend will never know you flagged a post, and what the friend decides to do will be private. In a test, the company says 25% of the Facebook users who'd written troubling posts chose to talk to someone. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Every month, one out of seven people on this planet wind up one way or another watching a YouTube video. The streaming video site owned by Google since 2006 has become, I think it is fair to say, a cultural icon, but still somehow cannot turn a profit. Rolf Winkler's piece on the company in the Wall Street Journal today is headlined, YouTube, 1 billion viewers, no profits. Rolf, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
What is YouTube doing then that it has $4 billion in revenue, a billion viewers, and it's not making any money?
What are they doing? What they're doing is they're investing in tons of servers worldwide to make sure that you get speedy videos with no buffering, and they're also spending a lot of money paying creators to produce the content that you see on YouTube.
What's the core problem then? I mean, what nut have they not yet cracked, do you suppose?
Well, one nut they haven't cracked is expanding their audience beyond teens and tweens. Those
right.
are really some of the viewers that YouTube today really, really caters to. A lot of people say YouTube needs content that will appeal to everyone else.
So let's just go ahead and say it. The problem is that a lot of stuff that's on YouTube is garbage.
A lot of it doesn't appeal to, say, you or me, Kai. That's absolutely for sure.
Okay.
The thing that really hits you is how tough it is to run YouTube. Because let's think about this. Everyone's saying, hey, invest in more content. Content creators are saying, hey, you don't pay us enough, a big enough share of advertising revenue. And meanwhile, let's keep in mind, this isn't a site that makes money. Now, there are some solutions they're looking toward. They're now looking at subscriptions, for instance. They want to create something like Netflix. They're starting with music. If they're able to build successful subscription businesses, well, then that's more money that they could potentially use to invest in better content.
How much of a problem is it for them that everybody and their grandma now is doing video, whether it's short form like Vines and Instagram or whether it's long form like Amazon Studios and Amazon Prime and Netflix?
I think the interesting challenge there is that for the first time, YouTube is going to have serious competition in 2015, and in particular from Facebook. You see Facebook streaming a lot more videos now, and it appears Facebook is working on maybe its own video destination. Makes sense that they'd be working on something like that, because why send all these video advertising dollars to YouTube, for instance, when you can be capturing more of those yourself? And the reason this is interesting, the reason this is a potential challenge, is that you don't go to YouTube.com a lot to check your videos. Right now, if people are treating it like a repository, a video repository, a library that you sort of go and look up that video and somebody else sends you a funny link. The point being, what if people started pointing to a different site? What if they're pointing to Facebook videos?
And that's the other problem, right? That YouTube is the old guy on the block now, so to speak. They're the giant that everybody's going after.
Absolutely. And one thing that they have going for them to keep in mind is that they do pay people. A lot of content creators, I report on YouTube all the time, and there's a constant complaint from them that YouTube doesn't pay us enough.
Hmm.
And the thing that YouTube says, and quite rightly, we pay you something. No one else is paying you anything. Now, that's for the moment, however.
Right.
And when Facebook figures out the revenue model and how to kick some of that back, well, then you could start seeing people shifting more from YouTube and going more to Facebook.
Rolf Winkler covers technology for the Wall Street Journal. He does it out of San Francisco. Rolf, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
We've been talking a lot about water the past couple of weeks, how we take it for granted, how what we pay for it doesn't reflect its actual value, and how doing that is eventually going to get us into trouble. Our series is called Water, the High Price of Cheap, and we've asked some writers to talk about water in their work and what it means to them. Today, Paolo Bacigalupi, author of The Wind-Up Girl and The Drowned Cities.
To me, the most important thing about water is that we don't notice it. And because of that, it means that it has the power to surprise us. You take it for granted because it's so stable for so long, and so it becomes part of your background. It's not something you pay attention to. And so then that moment when everything changes and you're surprised by it is a real shock. It's that the story that you missed. Oh, right, this is not a stable thing. This is dependent on all sorts of other larger systems being stable and sort of compliant. And if they aren't, it all goes to hell. My family has land that's irrigated by a federal water project. And so there was a drought year, and sometime in July, suddenly the canal that fed our irrigation systems was turned off because there was a call on the river further down, and someone with senior rights was going to take that water. There was still water in the river, but it was no longer ours to access. And in that moment, you realize that water is oftentimes a zero-sum game. Somebody might end up with water, but somebody else can be cut off and lose completely. Water shows up a lot in my work because I'm interested in stories that drag our future into unexpected places. Water is one of those things which is so fundamental and powerful, and yet we tend to not view it at all. We miss it. And because of that, it's sort of fertile territory for me to write about. You know, if I see something like Lake Mead getting lower and lower and Las Vegas drilling intakes lower and lower into Lake Mead to get at its water, that tells me something powerful is going on, and it gives me an opportunity to think about what scarcity might look like in the future and how we might be surprised by how intense that scarcity could be.
Paolo Bacigalupi's newest novel, it's out soon, is called The Water Knife. This final note today, another Kickstarter item, although a bit more troubling than the Pebble Watch we were talking about earlier, the one that broke the record for raising the most money the fastest. The Kickstarter with the most people supporting it, which happens to be 219,382 people, is a card game called Exploding Kittens. Here's the key paragraph from its Kickstarter page. Quote, Exploding Kittens is a highly strategic, kitty-powered version of Russian roulette. Players take turns drawing cards until someone draws an exploding kitten and loses the game, end quote. No, I don't know what's the matter with people either, but the thing did raise almost $9 million American dollars.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, a proud Marketplace sponsor for 7 years, committed to helping small businesses meet their goals with email and online marketing. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. By T. Rowe Price. In today's uncertain markets, institutions, advisors, and individuals choose T. Rowe Price to find global investment opportunities. T. Rowe Price. Invest with confidence. And by Kronos, offering cloud-based workforce management solutions designed to help organizations maximize one of their biggest investments, their workforce. More at Kronos.com. Kronos, workforce innovation that works.
All right, we have got to go. The Dow off 10 points today. That's a little less than a 10%. The NASDAQ gained 20 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 dropped itself 3 points lower. That's about a 10% there. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Nancy Fargali, Patty Hirsch, Cindy Johnston, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor around here is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody.
and this is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Jerez, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.